Good afternoon, listeners, and welcome to my Saturday afternoon radio program. I am Carolyn Yeager, and today is July 26, 2014. As I said on Monday, even though we're into the slow summer months, things are not slowing down. Right now, if you're a person who is a Holocaust revisionist-minded, you've been reading about the accusations and going back and forth between the new and improved, you might say, David Cole, or at least the new and returned David Cole, and just about every other revisionist of note. It can be called a debate that has degenerated into a dispute now fraught with name-calling, insults, and ridicule. I will have this story for you with plenty of insight, I hope, to bring to it. And I even have Frederick Tobin joining me in the second hour of the show with much of interest to say. To get us started, I thought I'd share with you a message I got the other day from Harry Cooper of Shark Hunters Incorporated. I had begun to receive Shark Hunters newsletters, you might say emailed out newsletters, again, and I don't want them. I'm not a fan of Shark Hunters at all. In fact, I have done a couple of programs criticizing Harry Cooper and his organization in the past, from which I got bad replies from Harry Cooper, who didn't like what I had to say. And he has, in the past, I've seen things in various places on the internet where sometimes my name comes up, and if he's there, he jumps right in and says what a terrible, terrible person I am. but, you know, be that as it may, I got the one, and I thought, well, why am I getting this? I thought maybe it was special or something, so I just looked at it, and then I deleted it. And then I got another one, big, long one, and, you know, he's promoting another one of his trips to Argentina, for which he charges people to, you know, go along on a cruise type thing. I think it is. Maybe they fly. I don't know. But he takes them there. And so I thought, well, you know, I don't want to be getting these again. I looked all over it for a place to unsubscribe, but there's nothing. There was nothing anywhere that even mentioned that you could tell them you didn't want to receive this because they don't want people to be able to do that. So I was going to just delete it, and I thought, you know, I'm not going to keep going through this. Why don't I just take a minute and send an email and see if it will work? And so I wrote these words. I said, please remove me from your mailing list. I did not request or give permission to receive mail from you. Thank you for your prompt action, Carolyn Yeager. I signed it. And of course, it comes from CarolynYeager.net email account, so a person would know that. But I signed it, too. And so the next day, I received a reply from Shark Hunters. And what did it say? I want you to know what it said. It said, normally, no dear Carolyn or Miss or anything like that, normally, we remove the email and wish the contact good luck. In your case, we remove you, and happily so, as you are nothing but a huckster and a charlatan, caring nothing for the historical truth. We have members who monitor your blog, so be careful what you post about us. Wet being spelled, misspelled, and also charlatan being misspelled. Well, I just had a little chuckle, but I thought, really? You know, obviously that was written by Harry Cooper, and Harry is a one-man show, I think, there. He's a one-man operation, and he does it all. But he didn't sign his name, or he didn't even sign Shark Hunters, just that. And I think it just shows that there are millions of people who fall for this man and love to be conned, and he expects everybody to fall for him and to believe him, that he is telling the historical truth in his books and his trips and his lectures and so on. And But if people want that, which so many people do, then it's their fault if they spend their money and fall into believing all of this stuff about that he's going to show them where Hitler lived and where Bormann is now. And I think for a lot of these people, they're willing to pay for entertainment and travel, and they think, well, I'd enjoy traveling with this group of people who will be talking about these interesting subjects, whether true or not, than just traveling on my own. So that's probably what's behind the reason that a lot of people, maybe at least a number of people, and I don't think a lot of people do go, but enough to make it profitable for Harry Cooper. So that's the kind of thing that goes on the Internet, as we know. You know, a lot of ugly behavior and name-calling and so on. And I get my share of it. I am critical of people, but I don't go at it in quite the way that they do, but they come back at me. But they don't realize. They think I've said worse things probably than I really have about them, and then they don't recognize how bad what they're saying is because they're so worked up over it. They're so angry. So we're going to look at some of that on today's program with David Cole, because I think there are two schools of thought here regarding Cole. There are those who think that any of the what has already been released, the bad language, the name calling, the ridicule, the scornfulness that he has expressed, basically David Cole has expressed it, somehow imagining that people who disagree with him have said terrible things about him. And he's very sensitive to that. He seems to be super sensitive. But these kind of things, the one school of thought thinks that this should not even be talked about. I've already talked about it, see, but this should not be mentioned. This has nothing to do with the revisionist argument, and the revisionist argument is one that has not been resolved yet, and it's good that we talk about it. I agree with that. Try to come to a better resolution about the Action Reinhardt camps, in particular, what's the one that's being used right now is Treblinka, and that's where that supposed archaeologist from Britain has been doing work at Treblinka in the past year and gotten a lot of publicity. So they're saying, let's just stick with the facts here and the arguments about what happened or what didn't happen at Treblinka and evidence we have or don't have. And I can respect that, but I think that from what has been coming out, that does a favor to Mr. David Cole, because he is the one who would get the worst of the bringing in the manner of argument, the behavior, the attitude of the various participants of the revisionists and how mature they behave and things like that, how emotional they get rather than really logical. So I think that all of it needs to be brought up, and I will probably bring some of that up today in my first hour, because in the second hour, Frederick Tobin is going to be coming on. I think I already mentioned that. I hope I did. But he will be coming on at the top of this hour and be joining us. And I know he will have a lot to say. It's very early in the morning for him right now. I think it's going to be when he does come on, it's going to be 6 a.m. I think it's 5 a.m. now. But he said he could be up because I didn't want to talk about this today on this program, not wait until Monday. So I'm going to go into the things that I think I'd like to say about it in this first hour. And I'm going to start with saying that this, what David Cole has stirred up, at least that I first heard about it, and I think it is since the July 23rd posting of an article about him at the Occidental Observer. Now, this article has been picked up. I know it was picked up at the Daily Stormer, and I had real questions as to why there was no commentary with it, just posted straight as though it was worthwhile, because it had been posted at Occidental Observer. I am going to start out by questioning the fact that Occidental Observer even posted this article. I'm not surprised, but I do have something to say about it. That first, you know, I had to ask myself, who the hell is Francis Carr Begbie? And, you know, what does he know about Holocaust matters, as Frederick Tobin puts it, always calls it, or he calls it Matters Holocaust. I like that very much. I think that covers it all very well without, you know, using a lot of words. Well, I saw that Begbie was a British subject. I saw that he had written something that was posted at the Occidental Observer in October 2013, titled "The Holocaust Industry in the United Kingdom," and it's basically a weak presentation of what all white nationalists already know, that the British establishment is hugely in league with and cooperating with the Jew World Order Holocaust industry. There's no surprises there. It was about the a monument that was put up and all of the support given to the Holocaust education and so on in the United Kingdom. I have written about that myself, but there's nothing there that Begbie can get into any trouble over. So I see him as someone who, then with this piece now, I see he's someone who doesn't really know much of anything about the Holocaust, except what the general white nationalists know or think about it. And he's just basically a writer who's looking for a good subject, a subject with current interest value, that he can put his byline on and, you know, make a few bucks and keep himself in the game, so to speak, keep his writings, something by him being published somewhere. And of course, this David Cole, since he came out with his book, since he reappeared over a year ago, and then he came out with this book, is timely and people are interested in it, so he wrote about it. But what did he write? And then, you know, before I go on, I have to criticize Kevin MacDonald a little bit too. I've never really criticized Kevin MacDonald for not dealing with Holocaust, but you know, if he allows his website magazine to publish something like this article by Francis Carr Begbie about David Cole's book, then he's putting his foot in to Matters Holocaust. But in a very weak tea approach that he has, and I don't think then he can continue excuse himself about talking about either World War II or Holocaust by saying that I don't really know anything about it, but I just know that it's not an issue that we're ever going to win on. That's basically how I see MacDonald's argument, or not his argument, he doesn't make an argument, but just what he says if he's ever asked about it. And it's true, he doesn't know anything about it because he doesn't want to know about it. He doesn't study it or look into it, and that's perfectly all right. He doesn't have to. I never did think he had to. And then he says, he also says that he doesn't deal with it because he doesn't think it's a winning issue. It's a losing issue, and it's best to just ignore it. But yet this article shows up, you see, on Occidental Observer, because this Begbie, Francis Carr Begbie, has written quite a number of articles there in the, over the period of time. But these were the only two that had anything to do with the Holocaust. So, again, I go into my kind of a complaint that, in general, that if you don't know, really know what you're talking about when it comes to the Holocaust, don't use it in order to get an audience or fill up a subject for a particular article or a particular radio program that you're doing, where you're going to be putting out false information and you're not able to defend either yourself, or you can't defend if you have a guest, you can't defend the person you're writing about. You're just giving out the current blah blah about the establishment view, basically, and you don't know enough to see that. So this is what happens here, and this often happens in white nationalist circles, because white nationalists think that in general they're Holocaust revisionists usually, but they often go astray with people like Mark Weber and people like this David Cole, which has really taken advantage of people who are lukewarm and just moderately informed and are willing to think that he's just a great, great guy. Now, David Cole has this personality that so many alcoholics have, that he's very likable. He's a good talker. He's sociable. He can really put things over on people, but it doesn't seem like he is. He can seem very sincere, and he might think that he is. I mean, he fools himself very, very likely. These are marks of alcoholics, and he has admitted, when you admit yourself that you're an alcoholic, I guess you really are. Here's a typical statement from a white nationalist on the Daily Stormer comments to this article by Francis Carr Begbie. And he writes, now this is the kind of thing that I would like to write back and say something, but I didn't, I don't, I hold back most of the time anymore. He says, "I like David Cole, even if I don't agree with everything he says." I doubt he knows what he should agree with or not. He says about David Cole, "He's articulate and well-spoken for the most part." See, again, he pulls back. He says something, then he pulls back from it. "I don't know what his beef with Forsan is about, and that's neither here nor there as far as I'm concerned. Cole's Auschwitz video was one of the first things I saw that got me into revisionism." Well, I'm saying he's not into revisionism. You know, he just thinks he is. And he goes on, "And watching his appearances on those talk shows in the early 90s, he's undoubtedly made mistakes and said stupid things, but I'm sure it's not easy being him and doing what he does." Now, there's one heck of a bunch of excuses there for David Cole. And David Cole doesn't allow one mistake by anybody that he's dealing with, and they're out and they're wrong. But everybody, for the most part, gives David Cole a pass, gives him a break. "Oh, I like him," because they do like him. And they like him because he's a Jew who's into revisionism. And they think that's just so fabulous. A lot of people don't say that, but that's really one of the big reasons behind their support of him and their protection of him, and they're pretending like he's not doing anything wrong, and he's doing a lot that's good. Well, let's see. This article, I can't spend too much time on it now. I've already spent too much time. It's The Strange History of David Cole, and I have it all here in front of me, but I'm not going to go any further in critiquing it, really, because I think what I've said already shows that I don't think that there's much to it. What he actually does is take what's known, is buy David Cole's book. Maybe he got it for free because he was going to review it. Who knows how these people operate. But he's got David Cole's book, and he pretty much writes from that book, you know, David Cole's story, what David Cole says, what he thinks, and so on, and how he talks about his life. And so it's all very, from David Cole's own perspective, what he's writing here. And I suppose that's valid for a site like Occidental Observer if you think that your readers are interested in him but haven't looked into him, haven't read the book and would kind of like to know. So they're going to get that from here. But it's all from David Cole's own perspective about what he's up to and how well he's done it and how right he is and who his enemies are. And here's one part I thought was real important, because I've got it in a larger type. David Cole, this is what Begbie writes about Cole. He says he is pro-Zionist who supports Israel, but has a low opinion of secular Jews who, while nominally foregoing their Jewish religion, have replaced it with the secular religion of the Holocaust, quote, for which no amount of revision or criticism was tolerable, unquote. By contrast, he had far less of a problem with Orthodox Jews than secular ones because their religious vision does not depend on the Holocaust. So, well, that's just, it's good to know that David Cole is pro-Zionist and does support Israel. And he says he has a low opinion of secular Jews because they have made the Holocaust their religion, whereas Orthodox or non-secular Jews have a real religion, the religion of Judaism, as though that's worth anything. But anyway, then the next paragraph, Begbie writes, in the earlier part of the book, he has much to say about the revisionists he admires, such as Bradley Smith, and what he claims are the fallacies and lazy historiography of other revisionists or even straight-out deniers like Robert Faurisson. He holds David Irving in high regard, though he says Irving goes looking for trouble. Then he says, while he has reservations about Ernst Zundel, he says that his one achievement should be noted that during his trial, Holocaust experts were forced to testify under oath. That wasn't exactly Zundel's achievement because it was the court that set that up, but Zundel brought the suit. So I guess, but in any case, that's not Zundel's one achievement, as he puts it. And then he says, what now for David Cole? He says he has rededicated himself to the subject of Holocaust revisionism, which was always his true calling. A blog post he wrote after his outing shows his attitude. The title of the blog post was Apologize My Ass. That's his kind of cocky attitude that he does definitely have, and he definitely puts it out there. But then Begbie says, whatever one may say about him, this is a courageous given, I think that's a typo, courageous act or something, given that he very easily could have renounced his views as the product of a misspent youth. So therefore, we're going to give credit to David Cole for coming back to revisionism. But the reason, which he called his true calling, Begbie does, but the reason he did it was because he can't do anything else now, which he has admitted. At least he's pretty honest. He's very honest, almost honest to a fault. But his honesty is tinged with sarcasm and cynicism. So, he says, if I could continue on as David Stein in the life that I had, I would be so happy. I wish I could, he says, but they've taken it away from me. So now, after denouncing Holocaust revisionism and disappearing for a long time and renouncing it, he comes back and he is saying that people are forgiving him, saying that, well, what else could he have done? They were going to beat him up and so on. They were beating him up. They were attacking him. So he had to save his life, and he was young still, and he deserved to have a decent life. So what he did was fine, and it's really too bad that he isn't able to continue in it. So just serious is he about Holocaust revisionism now? How much does he really care about it since he walked away from it and even made a living making pro-Holocaust films for the Holocaust industry? But now he's back, and but the thing is, instead of instead of helping revisionism, he is arguing what he has joined forces, or he, I don't know if you'd call it joined forces. He has taken sides in a very the last really controversial part of it, as far as revisionists go, the so-called Action Reinhardt camps. He's taken the side of the two weakest non-revisionists, really, and that is David Irving and Mark Weber. And Mark Weber is only taking the side of David Irving. So in my estimation, while somewhere here it says that these three, he says, we three came to this conclusion separately that Treblinka was a death camp because of the documents like the Corher report and the Hufle telegram and then a few other little signs, that we came to that separately. But I would say that David Irving came to that, and Mark Weber took it on because David Irving had, and then now David Stein is taking it up also because of David Irving and Mark Weber, because he's happier in their company. And so here we have him already in his book pointing out, calling Robert Faurisson, who was it's hard to say who would be the number one contributor to the success or to the advances that Holocaust revisionism has made. But one in the running is certainly Robert Faurisson. And he's given up a whole lot and worked his tail off, you know, at times. And he's traveled around. He's gone out of his way in all kinds of ways. He has everybody's respect. But David Cole has the chutzpah to say he's lazy and just a denier. He's not a revisionist because he wants to call him a denier because he doesn't accept that that there were some Jews killed in gas chambers, which David Cole presents as the least that we can do once we've debunked Auschwitz and Majdanek. He goes along with that since he was a part of doing it. But there, that we don't have to say that there were no death camps at all. Well, how far do we have to go with this? Do we have to just have it all? Can't we leave the Jews something? That's basically, he doesn't say those words, but that's basically what he's saying. Don't take everything away from the Jews. They need to have something. We don't want to show them to be liars or whatever. So he's really moving toward the Jewish side, no doubt, no question about it. He's becoming, he's letting his Jewishness come out. And therefore, Robert Faurisson, who doesn't go along with that, is a bad guy. And so is Ernst Sundel, who is also just a denier and not a revisionist. But the fact is that he says he had said in his book and up until a couple of days ago that Bradley Smith was one of the true revisionists that he still admired because he was cutting them off, others off, right and left. But now Bradley Smith has released an email exchange between, or a Facebook exchange, something, which I haven't seen the original, but I saw, the copies of it, between himself and David Cole. And now, I'm going to go through some of that. Now, Bradley Smith has been cut off totally forever and ever, forever, from David Cole. David Cole is somebody who is, it must be, it can be a lot of reasons, but it also fits his alcoholic personality, that he gets, he's super sensitive, and he takes things, he's finished with something. I've got a lot of examples here where they just came along with the whole thing, where he says, this is my last post, and then he writes another one and then another one. He keeps saying, this is my last one. Or he'll say to somebody, I'm done with you forever, forever. And probably he's not. That's probably not true. But he uses extreme language and is extremely insulting to all of these men that we're going to take a look at here. So it's quite amazing. And I think that this article by Begbie, somebody wrote, Brett wrote about it, that he thought it was far too kind, that he got it just right. It's far too kind to David Cole. And I don't like to see things like that on websites that I otherwise admire and see as having high standards. But this is what happens when it comes to Holocaust and when it comes to Hitler and World War II and Germany and the SS and the National Socialism and so on. It's just people don't have any strength, and they don't want to deal with it. They think it's not good for their cause, and so therefore they get, they make some mistakes, like Kevin McDonald publishing Greg Johnson's essay a couple of years ago. That's when he closed comments shortly after that, because the comments were so, there were over 700 comments. That got everybody going. But these things are kind of good, because obviously it's necessary. There's no comments for this Begbie article. They don't have them anymore. But I think Daily Stormer made a mistake in posting that too, and didn't really think about what was in it and didn't understand what's going on. So maybe they should publish something that explains all that and tells a different story about David Cole. But David Cole went after Faurisson, he was doing this on his Facebook page, and he has said since that he considers his Facebook page private, and therefore he's not writing for public consumption. He's just writing to his friends and so on there, and he shouldn't be quoted from his Facebook page. So when some people copied and sent out his comments on his Facebook page, he got angry, obviously, I guess, and then he's closed down his Facebook page, sort of, except unless you're one of his special friends. But these things have gotten out there, and then what went on between he and Bradley Smith, which I think Bradley wrote that went on July 21st. So, but Bradley didn't publish it, but after all this other stuff came out just yesterday or so, he did. So we have what David Cole said about Faurisson, what he said about Fred Leuchter, and then what he said about Ernst Sundel, and what he said about Bradley Smith. And in the meantime there, within that, a few other people were mentioned, not positively. So, now I said I was going to talk about the facts of this case. So I'm going to have to skip all the rest. You can all find that. I can't cover all that. But I can I'm going to see where I've got this thing where he writes about how he's proven it all. This is the Smith thing. Okay, David Cole's article on Treblinka. I finally came to the understanding that that he had sent this to Bradley Smith, and Bradley Smith was going to publish it, I guess maybe on his founder's page or somewhere on Kodo, I don't know. But he hadn't done it yet, and David Cole was getting angrier and angrier at everybody, and so then he got angry at Bradley too and accused him of not being willing to publish it. So he's going to have, he asked his publisher at Farrell House, Adam Parfrey, to publish it. And then it was almost immediately, I would say, published, well, at least, since that was the 21st, at least a couple of days later, but it was published on Adam Parfrey's Facebook page, not his, the Farrell House Facebook page. That's what I think. But you, I can't see that either. I'm not a member of Facebook, and I don't want to be. So, but I don't know if it's still there or if it's been taken down. But this was something that David Cole apparently wanted to get out there. And it's his article on Treblinka. And he starts out saying, this is the most important thing about his argument that proves, according to him, that that Jews were gassed. He doesn't prove anything about gassing. He just he thinks that he proves that all the Jews mentioned, 700,000 supposedly at Treblinka or something like that, were killed there. They were killed there somehow, and they disappeared there. So they were buried there, or they were cremated there. Ashes were thrown to the wind, or they were buried, or they were... He doesn't answer any of those questions, only that these Jews went there and never left, like it's, you know, been said so many times. And therefore, they were killed there, and they're dead, and this was done by the Nazis. So, and of course, I think most people should know by now that he, David Cole, has said in his book, that he hates Nazis, and that if there's, he says, I don't hate anybody, but then he says, oh yeah, there's one group I do hate, and that's Nazis. So just as I've said before, talking about him, that's just typical for a Jew. All Jews hate Nazis. He's, everything about David Cole has become 100% Jewish again since he has written this book. You know, when he first came back, he didn't sound this way. When he first got outed, was giving a few interviews and so on, he didn't sound this way. But after he wrote his book, and I think a lot of what he's doing, I find it hard to believe things like this, because it just seems so extreme and far-fetched and so cynical. But I do now, after all that I have read about him and all that I've got here on this page that I'm not going to be able to go over, but... I do think it's very possible that he is doing all this to get to sell his book. That he is creating all this controversy and all this anger against all these attacks on revisionists and all this stuff to bring his name up to get, because more and more people then will say, "Oh, I got to read that book and see what's in it." And I think selling that book is the most important thing to him, because he has even intimated, he tells the truth a lot of the time, you know, about himself. I mean, he's not able to keep everything a big secret. But he has said that this is his last chance, that everything was taken away from him. All that he hoped to live out his life as this Hollywood mover and shaker and so on and guy, he now with this book was his last chance to make money. Because he doesn't want to live without money. He's never lived without money, and he doesn't want to. And when he talks about money, he doesn't think about money like I, you know, like living like I do, or a lot of you do, but, you know, living well, you know, like Jews think about it. And so he's got this book, and he wants to make it probably a bestseller if he can do it. And I think he'd jeopardize a whole lot. A whole lot of respect and regard about himself, but he also probably thinks that he's on solid ground, because he would believe that if he stands with Irving, he's in pretty good company, and and if he and that he's got an argument for Treblinka that while it's maybe not strong, it can't be proven that it's not right, because it's very hard to prove anything about those camps because they don't exist anymore, and because there's not much about them, not much records, because really they were not important, even though I guess a lot of people were taken there, but they didn't stay there. So it's hard to do this. Plus the Jews have it wrapped up now, like with this with Caroline. Can't think of her last name now. The archaeologist shows. I mean, the Jews have got a whole lot of those areas cemented over and covered over, and they've got rabbi religious grounds for not allowing people to dig there, and just all kinds of things in a way that is very, it's hard for anyone who's just an ordinary revisionist with the means that we have to go and do anything there that would show, because they know that there's nothing there, the Jews, and so they don't want anybody digging there. They don't want anybody doing anything. So Caroline Cole, I think her name is, no, it's David Cole, Caroline something, she's there fiddling around, you know, making these little shallow digs in certain areas, and then she's not going to, and then she puts everything back. They're not going to dig anything for whatever, all the reasons that she comes up with. So she's just pretending that she's doing something and making, you know, fooling people and getting all the publicity that is given for that, to say that, she, oh, she's done all this and she's shown this and that, just in order to keep the public believing that the revisionists are just hard, sour grapes people who are deniers and haters and won't accept that the suffering of these Jews there. So anyway, Cole makes the point that, and I think this is a good point, although it's not the proof part, but he says Auschwitz and Majdanek and the other camps have been won that debate about those camps, that there were no gas chambers there. That, and now this doesn't make sense to me, say that if there were no gas chambers and no gassing and no genociding of Jews at Auschwitz, including Birkenau and Majdanek, and Dachau and any other camps that are still exist in some form physically that people go and visit. If there was no gassing procedures going on there, why would we assume that was going on in these camps far in the east, farther in the east, which were just very small places and no longer exist, and there's nothing there that you can, and you don't find any evidence of any of that there. Why would we believe that? Because they've got some theory that, well, they had to go as far away as possible in these little places, and all they did was gas Jews day and night there. You know, they kept bringing them in there, and they just kept pushing them in the gas chamber day and night, until they had killed so many thousands, so many hundreds of thousands. But then what do you do with all these? You know, what do you do with these bodies? See, that's always been the problem, and it's still not answered at all. So this is weak right here. But he says in this, now here in this article, his Treblinka article, he goes after Metonio and Jürgen Graf, Carlo Metonio. He says, hardcore revisionist researchers, this is right early in the beginning of it, like Carlo Metonio and Jürgen Graf, have pushed the notion that these Treblinka and the other Reinhardt camps were merely transit camps. And then he says, I can kill that argument with one sentence. Wow. You know, he has a need to boast and make himself a superman, you know. He does that a lot. He said, I can kill that argument with one sentence. And the sentence happens to be, way down here, he talks about the Corhair report that was made in 1943, at the beginning of 1943, about the statistics on the number of Jews that had been sent to these camps. The number given was 1 million of passing through the camps of the general government was 1,274,166. This is the number that's supposed to have gone into those Reinhardt camps. And then he says, now this is the sentence that he's going to prove that they weren't transit camps. Quote, the above numbers do not include the inmates of ghettos and concentration camps, unquote. Now, David Cole is saying that one sentence proves the whole thing. He says, let's go home. It's all over, you know. Nothing more to say about it, blah, blah, blah. Well, yeah. I don't know. For one thing, I'm not qualified to make the argument about this, and so I'm not going to. Lucky, I don't have to. But I will say that when he says that that this means that this sentence is saying that Jews processed through the camps in the general government were not inmates of ghettos and concentration camps following the processing. He thinks it means that after the processing, they were not inmates of ghettos and concentration camps. But he's adding that following the processing. It's just saying that that does not include inmates of ghettos and concentration camps. Maybe it was not maybe it was before the processing, not after the processing. Or who knows what that exactly refers to. You have to be someone like Carlo Mantonio to really answer that. But I think that he's trying to make it all hang on that one sentence. There are people who say even if he's right about that sentence, even if he's right about the Corhair report, you still need to show that all these hundreds of thousands of bodies were killed and cremated there. And what happened to them? I mean, because even if you successfully burned them up, and there was no way in the period of time that it existed to burn all those bodies, no way. See, the whole thing doesn't work out logistically at all. But he just ignores that in his argument. So But this is part of it that has to be looked at also, and these questions have to be answered also. You can't just look at one document and that gives a number of people, and then say, well, that's it, and that says that they were sent to these camps, and then say that's all you need. He says that what that says, that the Jews were processed through the camps in the general government, but they were not later sent to other camps or ghettos. Well, they might have been, you could say they were sent straight further east, but he doesn't bring that up. But he concludes from that they disappeared. He says that word means to disappear. The word, I looked that up. I might not have put it in here. It means he says it means to disappear. But they didn't disappear. How can you just say somebody disappears and that's the end of it? They went there. Weber and Irving have been saying all along. They were sent there. We don't have any record of them going anywhere else. David Cole says that this sentence in that portion of the Corhair report says that they were not sent to any other camps or ghettos. That's the way he interprets it. And that means they disappeared. And that's all. He says, then he says, need more proof that they disappeared? Here's the most important part in Corhair's conclusion. Here's what he writes. I've kept one sentence in the original German. Okay, now he gives us this from the Corhair report. From 1937 to the beginning of 1943, wow, that is 6 years, or maybe five or five and a half or something, the number of Jews in Europe has diminished by an estimated 4 million, partially due to emigration, partially due to the excess mortality of the Jews in Central and Western Europe, partially due to the evacuations, especially in the more strongly populated Eastern territories. And then the part that he leaves in German, he translates as saying, which are here counted as departed. Yeah, I did look that up, and it said something, you know, I couldn't tell because it's Google translation. So it would have to be a German speaker would have to, a number of them would have to chime in on that, what that really means. But I imagine he got a good translation from somebody he thought was reliable so he wouldn't look like a dummy. So that's what he says it says. So all this is saying is that there was a loss of 4 million people, and it does say that some were evacuated in the more strongly populated eastern territories. That's not real clear, you know. So he's saying that his conclusion here is that if the evacuated Jews were merely transferred from Poland to Ukraine or from Poland to the occupied East, why would these Jews be counted as among those who are no longer in West, Central, or Eastern Europe? Why would their status be equal to those who have died from natural causes and suicide? Well, we don't know. It's not saying all that, but that's how he defines departed, that these are all counted the same as departed, ones who died, ones who were, he says, well, it can't be ones who were transferred because where would they have been? They couldn't, because this includes all of West, Central, and Eastern Europe. Yeah, I don't have time, and I don't even have the ability to read things to know how to speak about this. But I know it will be. I know it will be answered. So I'm just trying to point out here how weak his argument is. It all depends on this Corhair report, and he's trying to con people. In my opinion, this is a con job. You know, he then adds the Heflin telegram, and then he calls it wanting to insist that there was exterminations at the Reinhardt camps. He calls it a fetish among revisionists that they have to have this physical evidence, and if you don't have physical evidence, you're not really proven anything. So he goes on now because he knows his weak point is in getting physical evidence. I wish I would have continued with what I was going to say right then because it was good, and I've already forgotten it since I went on. It's good enough. He's trying to argue that you don't need physical evidence. And he goes into a lot of dopey things here saying, well, you know, what about
I was doing pretty well here, but Colossus of Rhodes, he wants to compare it to the Colossus of Rhodes that doesn't exist anymore. Well, the Colossus of Rhodes disappeared over 2,000 years ago because it was destroyed in an earthquake, and we don't have any trace of it today. But he's talking about the remains of these camps from 1943 that we don't have any trace of anything there, and trying to say that, well, things disappear without a trace, just like a lot of things have done so. And he uses something from 2,000 years ago as a comparison. Things like that. See, I know what I was going to say. This is like a con job. My final summing up of this is that he's so used to conning people that he thinks he's going to con. He thinks he can. A lot of people will know better. See, he knows not everybody's going to fall for what he's saying. But he thinks it's good enough and it's strong enough that it will keep, like people waving their hands, keep people from seeing. And a lot of people will fall for it or will think, well, nothing can be proven. We don't know that the revisionists are right on this. He might be right. And David Irving might be right. Just keeping the whole thing going, that's pretty much what the Holocaust industry is all about. They know they don't have the goods on proving anything, but they just keep bringing stuff up, and they have enough people helping them, and maybe David Cole is now one of them, or he certainly is one of them, but whether he's consciously one of them or not, I can't say, but I wouldn't try to say, but he is certainly doing that, and it's all keeping the whole Holocaust alive, and obviously David Cole thinks it's in his interest to keep the Holocaust alive. He wouldn't be calling people like Zundel and Faurisson deniers if he didn't. That's Deborah Lipstadt's word. For him to be calling these other revisionist deniers and discrediting them. So what I see is that Cole is in the process, his interest is to discredit the good revisionists and all the work they've done. Because he can't discredit the Auschwitz thing because he was a part of it, but he can still discredit them by saying that now they're, that there really was a Holocaust in the East, and there really were all a number of, he wants to say about, I think he said 900,000 murdered Jews, but he may have a higher, if he's talking about the Reinhardt camps. Yeah, that might be a figure for something else. But he's working to keep the Holocaust alive. And he's got ideological reasons for it. He hates the Nazis. He loves Israel. He's a Zionist. I mean, none of this fits. And so for all of these people who, and the last point I want to make here before Fred Tobin comes on is that he wants to, now I just forgot myself again. My last point, what was my last point I wanted to make? His ideological reasons, was that it? It's terrible. With hundreds of thousands, he wants to prevent the Jews from losing their strong points. He wants to protect the Jews. No, I know what I was talking about. Him being protected. So many people in revisionism, and so many people who are just friends of revisionism, just all the people out there who say they don't believe in the Holocaust and who are anti-Jewish to a large degree, they somehow want to protect this Jew, David Cole. Now, why do they want to protect David Cole? There's a lot of them that do because they don't, even Bradley Smith, even all kinds of people, high and low, because they have this feeling that he's done good work or you have to give him a fair shake. But I think it's because he's a Jew, that they feel there's this there's this idea, even among people who don't think they have it and don't believe in it, but it's there in them, that they feel the need to protect individual Jews. This is a common reaction that went on in National Socialist Germany. It goes on all over in the white nationalist movement. It goes on all over in white countries, in our, you know, former white countries. It's this idea not to be across the board against somebody or something as an enemy that means every last one. They can't do that. And so they have to protect some of them. They have to show they're fair, and they have to do this, and they have to even like them. You know, oh, I like him. He's a likable guy. He is. He has that. He has that personality that I just already told you about. He's a likable guy, but we need to look past all those things and see what is going on here that we keep finding and befriending good Jews. And if you look at this particular Jew, David Cole, he came along and he was such a friend to revisionism. And look what he's done now. He's now in the process, after all these years, of trying to, and I think it's very clear, to discredit revisionists and our very best revisionists. All of our very best ones. He hasn't gone after Guillermo Rudolph yet. But Guillermo Rudolph has made a comment about David Cole, and I'm sure that that is going to cause David Cole to go after him. But I'm not going to say it, because I got it from Frederick Tobin, and Fred, and I think he can say it. If he doesn't say it, I'll say it. But anyway, Frederick Tobin is here, and so Fred, I was going to send you an email telling you, but you're probably listening, so I'm going to add you on to the call now. I hope you're there. Let's see. Better do it this way. It's add to group call. Let's see. Why do it tell me to do all this stuff? Why isn't it working? Add. Add people. Oh, he's here. I'm on his page. I thought I could just do it like I do it with what's happened. Oh, he's asking me a question here. Let's see. I have to write to him. Let's see. I don't know why I keep getting these little messages. Call Skype. There he is. I had to hit call Skype. I didn't know that. He'll answer now. Hi there.
Good afternoon.
Well, yeah. Good morning to you. And I'm sorry, as my usual incompetent self with this Skype stuff, because it threw me for a loop that it didn't work the same way as it does. I guess maybe before the show starts, it works a little differently than after the show starts. Anyway, all right, ladies and gentlemen, we're in the second hour. This is Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn, and now Frederick Tobin from Australia is here with us. And Frederick has written a book review of David Cole's book, which I did put on my website, carolynyeager.net, and it's gotten a lot of reads, more than anything else in a while. Very, very popular, and I think it's very good. And I wanted Frederick, to come on and discuss this whole matter, because since you wrote that book review, a lot has come out, and it has really pretty much confirmed some of your observations about David Cole's character, you might say, and personality, because of all the attacks he's been making on so many revisionists and his seemingly very thin skin. So what what would you like to start with?
Yeah, it's interesting to see how at one time friends are falling out. If you think that this is unusual among revisionists, this is not the case. I've always maintained that people don't change as such. They develop and they mature and they decline. Our current ideology, certainly in education, is that we must change our attitudes. We have to do this and that. For example, in education, or in Holocaust education specifically, a student at Adelaide asked some question, and the lecturer said, "Your question borders on the offensive." Now, David Cole also focuses on this kind of thing, where he says the right questions have to be asked. As far as I'm concerned, as an educator, as a teacher, there is no right way or wrong way of asking questions. In fact, if you say you have to ask the right questions to find the right answer, you're in a control mode. The best person, they're the brightest individuals who really think hard, they do not have a restraint on what kind of questions to ask. Whatever comes to your mind, it's this idea of thinking outside the box. And most revisionists are like that. They are individuals who have developed their thinking to a point where they can't take, as I put it bluntly, the rubbish or the bullshit that others are feeding them. And therefore they have reached that individuality which is jarring for a lot of others, especially the ideologues who want to keep a lid on their pet theory. Now, when I started in 1994 with the revisionist quest, one of the basic principles was that if we were to find evidence of gassing anywhere, evidence of any kind of gassing exercise, we would publish it. And unfortunately, to this day, Robert Forreson's maxim, no holes, no Holocaust, has still stands. If you identify, or if you define the term Holocaust as purely gassing, what Cole has done now is move with the others, Weber and Irving, into the Reinhardt camps, into the east, onto the Eastern Front, which Germa, Rudolf, Jürgen Graf, Carlo Matronio, and others have, and even now Eric Hunt, have accepted as this new challenge. Let's go and see, have a look at what's going on. Can we find evidence of gassings? And then, of course, there isn't, and then it'll be shootings. Well, these things are documented. Mm-hmm. And the big thing with David Cole now, I mean, just what you read out before, his statement there, we have to look at the documents. Well, with Germa Rudolf, I think it was in 2000 sometime, I spent time with him. We visited a fellow, and this fellow could produce any document you needed, for example, in the Kennedy case, in order to prove whatever theory you wanted to prove, whoever was responsible. This fellow had a house full of documents, and in other words, he could fabricate. And therefore, when Cole now says we need documentation, the Kohei report or the Hoefler telegram or whatever, these documents, it doesn't get away from the basic physical reality. And I formulated this, I'm glad to say, certainly for myself, and I presented this at the Tehran conference, the steps, the physical steps we have to worry about in gassing procedures, the undress, or first the lineup. For example, Auschwitz was usually the case. You line up, then you undress, then you gas, and then you cremate. At Treblinka, you actually added three extra. You were gassed, and then you were buried, then exhumed, and then the bodies were burnt. And this kind of physical reality we have to get back to.
Not a fetish. It's not a fetish now among revisionists that we have to have physical evidence.
The way I see it is that, if I may just finish, I just had this other thing then. I said the Holocaust has no reality in space and time, only in memory. And this is where Eric Hunt comes in with his videos, where he exposes the memory, the reliance on memory of those survivors who are absolutely discredited. And of course, Cole does admit that this happens, mm-hmm. but when he focuses on these other things, on documentation, that is the legal position, that enabled Irving to travel back into Germany, to travel all over and do his thing, because the concept of limited gassing will get you not arrested in Europe or anything or a conflict legally. So we've got Irving, Weber, and Cole, the three of them, have adopted this without evidence, although they'll say there's the written evidence.
But that's not even evidence. It's just a transportation.
Yes, of course.
It's evidence of transportation, but that's not enough evidence.
I know. This is his problem. But mm-hmm. in the meantime, he's out there. And I was really disturbed. I could not understand David Cole, who was really taken on board by Zundel and Forreston, that he made this biting criticism. I thought there was something wrong with him in doing that. It told me more about his mindset. It's like a lot of things. For example, there are individuals who refer to the general population as sheeple. I have a worry with that because I'm from a farm and we used to have sheep, and I certainly didn't think that sheep were stupid. They were not. But in any flock of sheep,
they're followers, right?
No. In any flock, you'd always have three or four who would go through fences and everything. They were the big toughies. They were the scouts. But the other ones would stay in the flock as a protective mechanism against foxes, for example, or dogs. Mm-hmm. And so when somebody uses the term sheeple, I worry because it tells me more about the person who is using that term in order to decry or denigrate somebody else. Because the way I approach this, and I had great worries when I reviewed David's book, because I wanted to meet him when I came through in my two revisionist world trips in 97 and 99. I wanted to meet him and through Bradley Smith, of course, and he refused. Now, I've got a worry when, at that time at least, when someone doesn't want to see me. Now it's different. When politicians in Australia see me, they run. They don't want to be associated with me. I can understand that up to a point as well. But David didn't want to. And now, of course, in his book, there's this interesting factor that he says he's kept secret for a long time, that since 1993 and 94, he was in contact with a rabbi, a wonderful rabbi, a family man, many children, who guided him in asking the right questions about the revisionist problem. Now, I had great worries when I read that, because it indicated to me that David was perhaps playing, I don't know whether you could say playing a double game, but certainly when I came onto the scene in 94, I wasn't aware of any of the camps that later on split the revisionist group. I didn't know, for example, that till very, very late in the 90s, if not even just a little later, after that, that this conflict had occurred with Willis Carter, that Mark Weber and other revisionists mounted a court challenge for whatever reason, that it was a legacy and so on. But the important point was that some people wanted to break away and form this new pure revisionist movement, taking away from someone who began, for example, the IHR. And what happened?
What are you doing? Are you messing around? Are you fiddling with your book?
No, I've got a problem. The speakers and other things are just, something's going on. I'm blaming. Who can I blame?
Well, I don't know. It just sounded like you were moving something, doing something, and it just kept going on. So I thought I'd ask about it.
Yeah, you do that, Carolyn. Yeah, excellent. Now I feel all upset.
No, you don't.
Oh. No. Only joking.
Okay.
No. So let me just finish this
on this
one point. For me, it's important that, for example, Willis Carter was bankrupted because of what Mark Weber did with the IHR, taking it from Carter. Mm-hmm. Now, bankrupted for life. Now, I was bankrupted in 2012 because I've lost all the legal challenges, and now I'm still in litigation, and on the 4th of next month we'll see whether we're going on or not. But, and so I still have to be a little cautious about what I say about my matter. But the Cole thing illustrates to me that the other side, the so-called Holocaust believers, are repositioning themselves. As you stated, they are trying to save what can be saved before the whole lying edifice crashes.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting that Cole had to get down to the point where he explicitly states he hates Nazis.
Well, now, let me just mention here, when you talked about sheeple, and you felt that people were putting other people down by using that term, and it really is for that purpose, because those who think that they are in the know and up to date on who are the bad guys and who are the good guys and the New World Order and all that, they call the other people sheeple. You know, so they're setting themselves up as superior to the other people, and yet some of these people are wrong in so many regards, and then you don't really know what all those people out there really think. So I think you're right about being sensitive to that and not liking that. The other thing I want to say is that I had mentioned that what Guillermo Arruda, I had said at the end of the program, my first hour, that the only noted revisionist that people are familiar with, whose names people are really familiar with, who hasn't been put down quite severely by David Cole, is Guillermo Rudolph. And then I said, well, Guillermo Rudolph had made a comment about David Cole, and now he will probably be attacked by David Cole too, But I didn't say what it was because you had just told me last night or this morning or something. So I thought I'd let you say it. Were you planning on sharing what Guillermo had told you?
I don't know what Guillermo said, but I can say, now I'm dissembling here, I can say what the powerhouse of revisionism has said about David Cole. He's neither a scholar nor an expert in the field in any terms.
That's
and
it.
And for me, when I heard this, I said, well, look, the David Cole issue's over. He's neither a scholar nor an expert in the field in any terms. Now, we don't need to say any more. Let David Cole go. Let him do his thing. Let him, as the British would say, give him enough rope with which to hang himself. Let him go on, discredit himself. When he broke with Bradley Smith, I thought that's sad, because Bradley, like all of us, we like Bradley a lot. Is there really the quintessence of the libertarian? He has a marvelous sense. He's constantly grinning, and that's not because he's senile. He's not senile yet. We're reaching all that stage very, very soon.
Yeah, we're all reaching that stage.
Yeah, and so I would have to ask you, oh, what's your name again, Carolyn?
Well, I've already forgotten all kinds of things on this program today, but they do come back to me. But, yes, yeah, so Guillermo says Cole is neither a scholar nor an expert in the field of revisionism in any terms. So, you know, I mean, I think we can take that as being pretty pretty definitive. And from what Cole has been reacting to of what other people have said about him, this is even more so. Well, he was very upset that Fred Leuchter said of him, he's not even a revisionist. And he repeated that to Bradley Smith and at least of that. He wrote that, and he's, thought, you know, how does he have the nerve to say that to me? And because Cole is seeing himself now as one of the most important revisionists, certainly more important than Forisand and than Metonio, than Graf, who have these wrong ideas about things, but he is the one who's holding forth for the absolute truth. That's how he sees it. So when he reads this by Guillermo Rudolph, he's going to attack Guillermo Rudolph too. And so, like you say, we haven't heard from David Irving on this. I probably won't either. But it's excitable about David Cole that he would say so many of the things that he said and not seem to care. He's just like burning his bridges behind him.
Yeah, not only that, you know, it wasn't necessary to criticize Forison the way he did. Forison's archive, I would suggest, is larger and more extensive in depth than what Cole claims he has as an archive, as his resources. Nobody can get past Forison in these matters. I've had my run-in with many. We've had disagreements, and there's nothing wrong with that. But to call Forison these names, it's too cheap. Likewise, isn't it a pleasure to have Fred Leuchter back again?
Oh,
and,
yeah.
You see, and this is what I reflected on before while you were talking. I was listening, and this is why the noise, I think, because I'm positioning the speakers.
Okay.
When Leuchter came back, and I thought, yeah, they tried to destroy him. They did destroy him, but he's back, very much like Willis Carter. They tried to destroy the Enterprise. They bankrupted him through the courts, and now he's back. Or he came back easily with the Barnes Review and so on, and American Free Press. Now, that is their spirit, when you know you've done nothing wrong, when you know that you're being attacked like that, it's actually a kind of compliment that you know you're doing right. The important thing is you have to last the distance. And Fred Leuter's coming back, and who else is there? The old guard, so to speak, is there. It's a pity that Mark Webber, well, perhaps he's aligned himself with Irving, and that point is not tenable. Jürgen Graf uses unashamedly moral terms to describe these people, and I tend to share Graf's view, because if there was this evidence, this physical evidence of gassings, then I would run with that story. And now in his book, Cole says we don't have to look at the physical evidence, we just look at the documentation. Now, that's a cop-out on research. And I think it was Max Planck who said the only truth is that which can be measured. And that's science, of course. And this is what the Leuchter Report, this is what the Rudolph Report is all about. These things were measured and the story fell apart.
Mm-hmm. One thing that Cole said that I thought was really far out was that Robert Faurisson should be grateful that Mark Webber gave him a forum for his work at the IHR for all those years. And so the IHR belonged to Mark Webber, and during that time even, he was just another revisionist there, you know, and then eventually he got hold of it. But to say that that Mark Webber is the IHR, and that he's all the things that the IHR did and Cole likes to point out to how much the IHR accomplished, and he wants to give Mark Webber all the credit for it. Amazing, you know.
Yeah. As I said, this is where he's being unbalanced and untruthful. Untruthful, another word for that is telling lies.
Yeah.
That's his opinion. He's expressing his opinion, and it's our job to then refute these things, especially for the younger ones, the younger revisionists that are coming through. And I think on my list, at least, I have Eric Hunt and Josh Blakeney, Samson Royal. He's the young fellow in Australia, 17 years old, and he is very critical of Holocaust education. And it's amazing that these young people, and of course Brandon Martinez, he got his fingers burnt with the religious fundamentalists who couldn't hack the kind of freedom that a revisionist needs in order to question everything.
Well, Josh Blakeney did a radio interview with David Cole, and he was very positive for him and didn't have any problem whatsoever with Cole's views about the limited gassings. Well, not so limited when you think of the numbers they're talking about.
Yeah. Now, I think, well, Josh Blakeney is straddling the line. These young people, they need to be given the freedom to roam. And usually if you get interviewed, you let the other person discredit themselves by letting them rabbit on and on. And that it's that kind of interview where it's not constrained. He didn't focus that much, so I would let it be for the time being. But ultimately, I think we've then got to get back to basics, and it's that old Forrest and Maxim, and that still holds anywhere. and where we have to define what we mean by Holocaust. If somebody throws out this Holocaust denial, you know, it's like this the term anti-Semite and racist and Zionist and so on. Cole was quite good at this, where he pointed out that the Jew can pull out the national card as a Zionist, the biological card as a racist, and then the religious card. We can't do that because immediately we'd be called racist and anti-Semite. I worry about the term anti-Semite. For me, it has lost its absolute meaning. Mm-hmm. Unless it's a language category, Semitism, but otherwise for me, if somebody calls me an anti-Semite, you know, it doesn't bother me because it doesn't say anything. But these smear words still have a certain power among those who are not as yet aware of what's going on.
Speaking of using documents, Cole says, well, we've got the documents. We don't have anything else for the Reinhardt camps, so we have to use the documents. Well, there's only two. The Corher report and then the Buffalo Telegram. And they're not, you know, they can be interpreted in different ways, even though he doesn't seem to think so. But, you know, there's only these two little documents. That's not sufficient. I think we've already said that. But, you know, I mean, with no physical evidence and no other kind of evidence and this very poor witness evidence, which Cole himself admits that witness evidence is no good. So he discounts that. He doesn't even try to use it. But he thinks that these two little documents are sufficient to prove all this, all these hundreds of thousands of exterminations. So anyway, though, to go on about science, you know, Frederick, you might find this interesting because I didn't have time to talk about it, but yesterday I found myself reading an article from, and I think it's Germar Rudolph's The Revisionist magazine on a PDF at GermanVictims.com. And this article was by Carl Nordling. I'm going to link to it in the program page, on the program post. Scientists Against Science, Carl Nordling wrote. He was a Finnish man who sort of became a revisionist as he was kept working with things he was interested in. And he writes about how science has been, scientists and establishment scientists and establishment, and then later establishment historians and everybody in the establishment has gone along with the status quo of the establishment and gives the reasons why and gives a few good examples that he goes into in depth how they did that and how it was untrue. And eventually, you know, starting with like Galileo and the truth about the universe. And then he went on and talks about the Big Bang Theory. And then he talks about Shakespeare, and he goes into Margaret Mead and a few other things where the establishment is so firmly entrenched, and then nobody, you know, you can't undo it, you can't throw it over, and you can't prove it, they don't allow you to prove it wrong, and if people write things that are opposed that, you know, that they've come up with, well, the other people in the establishment, the other scientists in their field or the other historians, stop them themselves. And they all do it because there's one of the reasons is because they've got all this work and writing already established and done. It's all based on the belief in this thing, like, you know, the earth, everything revolves around the earth in the old days. And then with Shakespeare, let's say all the, who Shakespeare really was, all these writings that have been done. about him would then be no good because, you know, they're all wrong. And same thing with one thing after another. And that fits, of course, then he moves on to Holocaust revisionism. But it fits exactly, whereas they've got so much, it's so entrenched. They've got so much invested in it that to say that it's all going to be thrown over, they can't do it. And I would say that they've got the power, Frederick, to keep it from happening. I mean, what does it take that these things are finally exposed? We still can't question who Shakespeare, who really was.
Yeah, you can question it, but for me, it's not really that important. I know Peter Wakefield Salt had a theory about this. If we talk about the strength of the Holocaust lobby, of it enforcing its worldview on us, then we have to go back to Galileo because Kepler and others. I mean, if you think that Johannes Kepler had to defend his mother against the accusation that she was a witch. So I liken this whole revisionist business as a kind of witch trial mentality, and we're in this. It's nothing new. If people who are in the scene or just coming into the scene, if they think, oh, it's terrible that we're having a go at David Cole, and David Cole's terrible for having a go at Morrison, this is human nature at work. This is the battle of the wills, I call it, where individuals are lashing out and so on. And it's essentially, this is where we then get to basic thinking structures. And, of course, I have my pet theory on this. I use the Hegelian dialectic, while Cole and others use the Talmudic Marxist dialectic, which is a death dialectic, where the opposites come together and one wins, one destroys the other. While the Hegelian dialectic, you have both of them coming together, and the new synthesis is that new information. You do not have to kill the opposition. Most teachers in the classroom or lecturers at university, at the moment at least, are riding on the Marxist mindset, where the opposite has to be destroyed. You see this currently in the political sphere, the way the Malaysian airline flights are being handled. It's a life and death thing where somebody's responsible. And did you notice, I'm just skipping now, but did you notice when the Mali flight came down, there was not much talk yet. When it's an insider job, you've got a whole team of information, a whole team feeding information to the world and building up this overarching narrative of why something happened. And although I usually don't go to veterans today, but I got an email just this morning where Gordon Duff says the Ukrainians now are pretty likely to have brought down the Malaysian airline flight. Now,
I find that laughable.
And beyond that, but the important thing is, this is the second Malaysian airline that's gone down, and why, as Michael Mazur said, it is, and brother Nathaniel also, because the Malaysians last year had the audacity to hold a war crimes trial and found the Israelis guilty of war crimes against the Palestinians. Now, this had to be punished.
Well, now this is real conspiracy theory stuff you're getting into now, Frederick.
Isn't it lovely? Isn't it lovely?
Yeah.
but we then go back to the physical. This is what I'm getting at. We're looking at this overarching narrative of who did what and what happened and so on. And the physical evidence, for example, our prime minister said, oh, it's terrible how the Russians or the separatists are handling the evidence and so on. Yet in 1996, we had the Port Arthur massacre, and the 30-odd people were killed by this allegedly one man, and yet not one autopsy was carried out. Even this is unusual, especially if overseas people die in such incidents. And this is amazing that not one was autopsied to find out what they died of or how they died. No forensic evidence in the where this Bryant, the alleged killer, sat in the restaurant. No fingerprints, nothing. But the narrative was clear. He did it. And so we can draw the parallels when there is no real uproar if an accident occurs. Then, you know, 9/11, you have the same thing with the planes going down. Soon after, a plane crashed, and you saw the fuselage, you saw the elements there, and you then realize, look, the physical evidence, if it's an insider job, quickly gets taken away.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah.
And so it is. So it is with the Holocaust, with the camps. Cole says, are these four camps where it all happened? Oh, the Germans got rid of it. You know, the Germans, on the one hand, they're so stupid. On the other hand, they're so smart getting rid of evidence.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know. And that's been brought up many times, but somehow it doesn't make a dent because propaganda works. Propaganda really works. I'm getting so sick of and propaganda is coming out on all sides, and everybody uses it. And that when you're using propaganda to try to promote your own side or your own ideology or your own objectives, you lose sight of the truth. You lose sight of truth, and you don't value it because all you value is that I want to get my message across to as my propagandistic message. Well, I want to go back to Carl Nordling here because what he's saying here is that to use the scientific method. And, you know, Cole made comments that the only real Holocaust historians are Irving and Weber, and that these others are not historians. And yet, you know, what you need mostly for Holocaust research is scientists, right? You need this. Yep. You need a lot of the revisionists are scientists. Or they use the scientific method. And Carl Nordling said that he discovered that he could use the scientific method in any field, and it was better than these other methods, which ended up by just following the establishment status quo. And he mentioned Robert Faurisson as being his. His guiding light in that, or my problem with my coming up with my vocabulary words lately. Anyway, he writes, a careful reading of Hilberg revealed, however, that his figures were merely assumptions. He had gone looking for the truth about the Holocaust, so the first thing he did was read Hilberg's book of the destruction of European Jews. But he said, He realized it was all based on assumptions, and he had to look for other books as well. Soon, I came across a book in which I encountered a certain Professor Robert Faurisson. Although he did not have all the answers, I realized that his method for solving knotty historical questions was certainly the right one. The more I have read of his writings, the more I have come to admire the strict exactitude that is his hallmark. I have made this exactitude my guiding star as well. And that's what attracts me also, Fred, to Robert Faurisson when I read him. And he says, even if my studies have been mostly in other fields than National Socialist persecution of Jews, I realized that I could do my share also in this field. So he said the first thing he did was to gather all the biographic notes in the Encyclopedia Judaica that dealt with Jewish personalities who were subject to German rule during World War II. He said, thus I could make sure what actually happened to at least one significant group of intended victims. Anyway, then he goes on to demonstrate how some historians and scientists have grossly neglected the most elementary rules of their own profession in flagrant contrast to the spirit of Robert Faurisson. But now Cole is saying just the opposite about Faurisson, that he is lazy and doesn't do the work that's required that he, Cole, has done.
Yeah, look, it's I'm sad for me to see that David Cole has used these words on Forreston, because again it reflects, it tells me more about what's going on in Cole's mind, and there's not much going on, but what he's done, and I wondered initially whether he actually wrote this book or whether he had a team slanting it. It would fit in with the pattern of repositioning Holocaust revisionism by conceding Auschwitz, which he does, and then going into others, Natzweiler, for example, which is a nonsense. But revisionists have like Germa and Carlo and Jürgen, they've mentioned this trend. It happened 20 years ago where they were moving away from Auschwitz. Remember in 92, 93, when Cole got that interview, then Robert Jan van Pelt and Deborah Dwork brought out the book Auschwitz from 1270 to the present. 1270, I think 1270.
Mm-hmm.
And there they concede that Crema won. They conceded Crema one was gone. It, symbolically, it was dressed up to represent what happened in Crema two. And then Gita Sereni in 2001, I think it was, and then Fritjof Meyer in 2002 or 3, they had admitted that Crema two, Birkenau, that's gone. The gassings happened in two farmhouses, which never existed. And so slowly, those who upheld the dogma of gassings had to concede. And this we can thank Ernst Zündel massively for having had the strength to run his 85 and 88 cases, which then on appeal in 93, he was liberated. And then, of course, by 93, 94, the Holocaust industry began with the Human Rights Commission, where you didn't need evidence, where hurt feelings was enough to have you convicted, as in my case, and Zündel escaped to America, and then they got him on this other business. But you can see how...
Well, see, now that's what corresponds exactly with the other things in history, like the Galileo thing and the witch thing and so on, where if they don't get their way, they just come up with legal constraints against it. And they, even if they don't make any sense, but they have this power. See, they're established. They've got the power, and they use it. This is the problem. I don't know.
Yes and no, Carolyn. This is one reason when I started in 94, I realized most of the physical research had been done. And look at series of Holocaust handbooks. Barnes Review's got, I think it's 25, and the latest one coming out will be Matonio's thing again on the gassing. It's all there. But I then decided that I would look at the legal aspect of things. I just finished 10 years of fighting our education department on things, and so I thought, let's do this. And in 97, I went to the public prosecutor in Mannheim, and of course, we had a good discussion, and I realized that they do not discuss, they simply define and say, this is the orthodoxy. And for me, I couldn't really accept that, because if there is an orthodoxy, then let's look at it. Let's see what they're saying. So when I revisited the fellow at Mannheim 2 years later, also in April, 99, then, you know, the obvious thing is he had me arrested. Now, one fellow said, because I had done this, it was a stunt, and it shows that I'm a Zionist or something like that, because no sane person would go to a public prosecutor's office. Well, I'd gone there once, So I went there again. And in some ways, it was the best thing that I ever did, because I learned much more by being arrested, by being tried, by being in prison, and so on. And this is, I wanted to make this point. The important thing for revisionists is to have a base, to have a community within the physical community where they're living.
Mm-hmm. And that's what they succeeded in destroying with Mark Weber. But he wasn't alone in that. He had all these others helping him. And this shows people go wrong, how they get sucked into things that it's not that hard to do.
Yeah, and this is where, if you go to my website, tobin.biz, B-I-Z-Z, that's your Z, isn't it? B-I-Z. You'll see, I've just had two photos put up, because a couple of weeks ago I received a certificate of appreciation from the South Australian Police as my contribution towards Neighbourhood Watch. Now, this is what the Holocaust believers, or those who are fighting the dogma or the upholding of the Holocaust, hate. If somebody like a revisionist is still within a community. For example, when I was imprisoned in 2009 in Adelaide, my teacher registration was under question, because as the registrar wrote me a letter stating, you have been imprisoned and we are about to cancel your teacher registration. And I questioned this. I said, being in contempt of court and then being put in prison for that is not a criminal matter. And if they were to continue with the deregistration process, I would take it to court. At that time, I wasn't bankrupt, so I could still go to court.
Okay.
And what happened? They then dropped it. So this year, I let my registration go. But the important thing is for revisionists to have a physical base, to have a physical community. That is the important point. And as I said, my so-called enemy doesn't like it when I can put up things. In 2001, I got a certificate, volunteer of the year, or something like that. All these little community efforts that I indulge in, even before that, in a community, tidy town things, and so on. In other words, I'm integrated into a community, and they see old Fred Tobin coming along. Oh, Fred, you're in the news again, Fred. Oh, yeah. All right then. Yeah, you know, they know that I'm a pretty ordinary fellow. There's nothing extraordinary about me. And that is the important point, because if you have the attitude of the sheeple, oh, look, these people are all stupid. No, they're not. They're just too busy trying to make a living.
Okay. And you know what? Going back, because we're almost out of time here, and going back to the important point, Fred, about the Action Reinhardt camps, is that in another article by this David Wilson at Inconvenient History in 2009, he points out, and this has been pointed out so many times, that the time interval that they had in which to gas all of these people and to bury them and to dig them up and to cremate them and to get rid of all the traces and so on, was simply not enough, because this was all finished like in 1942, wasn't it?
The premise on which this argument rests is that the Germans hated the Jews so much that they spent all their time killing Jews and not worrying about anything else. Because time-wise, you can work out how long it would take. And it's just absolute nonsense.
He says that David Irving assumes that all of these people in these Eastern camps were killed by December 1942. But see, yeah. this writer says that's impossible. That is impossible to have happened. And the whole calculation is impossible because there was not enough space or enough time in the way that this is presented to have accomplished all of that. So these things are never brought up when they come up with this Corehair report.
Look, David Irving is not a revisionist. He is a military historian of the Second World War. He admitted this. The revisionist for him is a side issue. He remember in 93 he had the video that he was going to sink the Auschwitz in 5 years' time single-handedly and so on. Well, that was because Stuart Joel Hayward had written his master's thesis at Canterbury University in New Zealand, where he debunks what happened at Auschwitz as a revisionist, saying no gassings, no evidence, and so on. And it was embargoed, just like that researcher with Treblinka, and her findings also embargoed. Hayward's thesis was embargoed for 5 years. Now, research should be published immediately, but it was embargoed for 5 years. Then what happened? He sent me the thesis, and I presented it as evidence before the Human Rights Commission, and they never looked at it. This was in 98. 2 years later, 99 and 2000, the university held an inquiry. Hayward recanted because he got death threats. He had a nervous breakdown, and he resigned from his lectureship at Massey University. And then 2 years later, he got a job at a defense academy in England. He's now converted to Islam, and he has, I think he's somewhere in Dubai. But the important thing is his thesis still stands. The university refused to downgrade it to a bachelor's degree because he had not lied. But he recanted, and I'm still waiting for him to give me the reason on which he based his recanting.
Well, what about Jürgen Groff? Hasn't Jürgen Groff written something in response to David Cole just recently?
Oh, yes.
Have you seen it?
No.
Oh, you haven't seen it yet. Okay.
Hang on. I just wonder whether just Forrestons. I'm just flicking through. Santa Moro.
Okay.
Oh, 90 seconds left.
Yeah. Well,
let me just read Fred Leuchter's, the way he says, I do not like to see infighting amongst revisionists and quite often get in the middle and try to mediate. Unfortunately, it was not possible in this case because you decided to publicly display your malicious slander against Forrestal and the rest of the revisionist community. Your conduct in this affair is reprehensible. You are a Johnny-come-lately to revisionism who managed to get Piper to admit to the Russian fraud, and so on. That's
yes.
Fred Leuchter summing up on David
Well,
Cole.
I'm anxious. I'm looking forward. I think you're right that this could be a good thing. I'm looking forward to hearing from all these different revisionists and bringing this issue up, you know, up in the forefront, because I think this Action Reinhardt camps is important, and this maybe will kind of goad everybody to have a response to all of this. I'm anxious to see what Jürgen Groff has responded. So we will say good night then. We'll say good afternoon, I mean. Say goodbye to our listeners. And Frederick, I want to thank you so much for being on.
And good morning.
Yes, it's morning. It's who knows what it is everywhere. So,
Bye-bye.
This is a sign off. Yep. This has been Carolyn Saturday afternoon with Carolyn Yeager, and we'll see you again next week.
Yeah. Bye-bye.
Well,
yeah, that was it.
I guess. Yeah. She often says thank you or something, but I don't see anything now. Oh, we're still on.